Hi, you've tuned in to the Lovely Travels podcast, where we talk about all things travel and adventure. My name is Emma Lovell, also known as Lovely, and I have a mission to visit every UN-recognised country in the world while raising awareness for mental health. Join me as we revisit some of my past adventures, speak to fellow travellers and interesting locals, all while following the journey to 195 countries. I'll be joined soon by my co-pilot, Darius, in Germany. And sometimes we're even going to hit the road together. Make sure to join in the adventure by following me on Instagram, Lovely Travels. You can also join our Facebook group, Lovely Travels Community, and learn more about us at the website, lovelytravels.com. But for now, it's listening time. Travel vicariously along with us.
Hello and welcome everyone to another episode of the Lovely Travels podcast. With me here today is Emma, and we are introducing the episode number, I shouldn't number these, Bhutan.
Episode number Bhutan. Yes, that is exactly right.
Episode number Bhutan.
I'm very excited for this episode.
Yep, me too.
Why
are we excited, Emma? Why? Who is the lovely guest?
The lovely guest is my dear friend Nick Newling, and we travelled to Bhutan together in 2015 on the Trek to Happiness, because Bhutan don't really do the whole productivity GDP thing, you know, gross domestic product. Blah, blah, blah. Right. They do gross national happiness. And so it is one of the places in the world that, you know, really focused on the well-being and the health of their people and maintaining their beautiful culture. And, yeah, it's really, really unique place to travel.
When did you go?
2015.
Wow,
and Nick
not
went
that long
also
ago.
In 2013. And Nick and mm-hmm. I met in Peru when we did a trek in 2012. And right. We got on like a house on fire, which you'll hear in the episode. But we also have a shared passion for mental health. And Nick is an amazing advocate for mental health and talking about suicide prevention and raising awareness about mental illness through his organization, The Champions.
He sounds like a great guy, this Nick.
He is a great guy. He goes into schools and does talks and just shares his story really openly. And, yeah, he's, you know, it's quite a heavy topic, mental health. So he brings a fun and lightness to something that's quite deep and serious and just keeps that conversation going and something obviously I'm very passionate about too and sort of a reason for Lovely Travels starting. So both of us actually on that Bhutan trip had a bit of a kind of wanting to do more for mental health and wanting to have more of a mission to what we do in life. And I said, look at us now 5 years later and we're both talking about mental health in our various channels.
Sure. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should quit faffing about and get right into it.
Let's listen in to Bhutan.
Bhutan.
Hi, Nick. Welcome to the Lovely Travels podcast.
Thank you for finally having me on the podcast. I've been sitting here waiting for months. When will she ask me?
When will she include me?
Always the bridesmaid and never the bride of the Emma Lovell podcast. But,
hey, you do a lot of speaking anyway. It was actually, you know, trying to fit you in because trying to get you to fit us in because you are a speaker man, but we'll get to that. So, well, we start with the question, who are you? Who are you, Nick? And how do we know each other?
Who am I? How much time do we have? God, what a deep question to begin with. My name is Nick Newling, and I, among a bunch of other stuff, spend most of my time doing mental health education and suicide prevention education. So I speak a lot in schools and in workplaces and anywhere that people will have me, really. And I live in Sydney. I have a lovely wife and a little boy named Finn and a beautiful dog named Peanut. And that's probably the most interesting part about me.
Yes.
And how do we know each other? Well, you and I, let's see, we met, was it preschool or was it primary school?
A couple of years just, after that.
That's right. Yeah, I'm just keeping it. I want to make sure you're listening as well. So I'm just going to see if you're fact-checking me. We actually, it feels like we met that long ago. We met, I'm going to say about 7 years ago, was it?
2012, so 8 now.
7 or so years?
2012.
So what's that math? 8 years. We met through our trekking, our fundraising trekking all over the place. So it's been a wonderful journey of work and what has become a wonderful friendship.
Absolutely, yes. So we were off to Peru that year. We went to Machu Picchu to raise money for Black Dog Institute. You had previously been to the Great Wall of China raising money for Black Dog Institute, who you worked for at the time.
I did, yeah. I was there for 6 years and I was there, yeah, through China, Peru and a couple of Bhutan treks.
There you go. And that's what today's episode is. We will focus on Bhutan, but we will definitely cover off some of the other things too. So you were just reminding me there was sort of a special moment we had in Peru.
We did.
On our trek.
We did.
What happened?
Yeah, it was very special. So I had decided for whatever reason that to get the perfect photo on top of the top of Machu Picchu. So at the end of it, and you'll pronounce it a lot better than I can because you don't speak Nicklish, you speak Spanish. So there's Machu Picchu, which means small man. Machu Picchu is, okay, so you imagine you're standing at where the photo is taken that you see on the postcards, you're looking to the very end of it, there's the site itself, and the end of it is that big peak.
Yeah.
And that's why new picture. I think
the pointy bit.
The pointy bit. And so we actually trekked up that part. And at the very top of that part, I thought, oh, I should probably bring like a suit and tie to get a nice photo. And so we're like very, very sweaty. Get up to the very top. And it took a long time to get out of my trekking gear and into this suit and tie. And for the time I did, it was probably 10 minutes or so. And you were kind enough to wait and take a photo of me over the site there. And what I wasn't aware of, there was probably about 10 or so people who had gathered, who were just waiting around to see what was happening. And at the very end of it, you took a few photos, put the camera back, and I got back in my normal clothes again. And then this crowd of people who'd gathered were sort of, oh, okay, and sort of went back about the business, lying down again. And what I didn't know, being a non-Spanish speaker, that you told me they were saying, this guy's about to propose. Everyone stick around and watch. Get your cameras out. Look what's going to happen. Not knowing I was just some idiot who wanted to
Instagram. Just wanted a sort of wicked photo.
I guess he got cold feet. I don't know what happened.
Oh, so, these people don't even like each other. They don't even know,
I know
each other.
So, so basically I went to the top of Machu Picchu to disappoint a lot of other tourists.
I was the most disappointed, I feel, you know. a lost moment. I love your beautiful wife. She's wonderful. You know, still heartbroken, still mourning that loss.
You're going to every UN-recognized country to experience the world, and I'm going to every country I can to perpetually disappoint people. So we have very different goals.
Just to be a bit of a dickhead.
Yeah, maybe.
That's pretty fair. All the countries I was a dickhead in, because you and you and Phil, you were up on the peak on our day off with your shirts off. Pants were on, shirts were off.
I you know what, this is people, I'm going to get a reputation on your show, Matt. There was a moment of that in Bhutan, because we were surprised by the snow, weren't we? We'd sort of got the first snow of the year, and I think they weren't really anticipating that. So we'd established a camp and it had just bucketed down. And then in the morning, we're like, oh, look, there's snow everywhere. So me and my tent mate, Phil, Bagdrop, we climbed to the top of this little mountain and we thought, you know what, let's get a little photo. Because when you're doing fundraising trekking, it is actually legitimately a helpful thing to have something visual to show on social media that kind of gets people a bit excited about maybe donating a few more dollars.
Yeah, so absolutely. And look,
for taking our shirts. We did keep our pants on from...
Well, Pot Kettle Black, because at the Tiger's Nest, I took my pants off. So I had black loose trousers on. I took them off, and underneath I was wearing rainbow unicorn and dinosaur tights.
I do remember that. That is an image seared into my brain.
Posed with my bottom, you know, well, covered but very prominent. So anyway, it's a good photo.
Respectful of local customs, but also bringing your own flair.
Just decking myself on a peak.
Well, you know what? So, now I think about it, because I had my business cards are all on the back of each one is a different Instagram photo from our The Champions account. Which is really cool. And then one of them, I was like, oh, that's right. I have to sort of print out hundreds of them. And one of them was actually when we were up at the Tiger's Nest in Boot. I'm sorry, I'm jumping all over the place here. But
we are.
There was a couple of monks who wanted to get a selfie with me. I guess they thought, I was like, wow, that guy must be like a celebrity. He's wearing a suit and tie and looking all schmick. And I'm like, no, under this, I'm sweating and a nobody. But they were really excited. So I got a little photo of them getting a photo with me. So no, it's been lots of fun.
It's a fun idea doing things like doing those things is really fun. But like, you do pick the toughest moments. Like, Wana Pichu was 100% the hardest part of that entire 4-day trek. Yeah, like, we had a time limit too, so I think that was part of the you know, it was like we had to get up and down and off in 45 minutes, and you're faffing about with a suit for 10. It's like,
Did I know about that time limit at the time? I don't recall if I did.
If you did,
maybe
I'm sure you didn't.
Maybe it was sort of
really
in one ear and out the other. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel you didn't mind much. And then the same with Tiger's Nest. That was a brutal trek. Like, that's like a stroll at the end of our 6-day trek. They're like, we're just going to visit the Tiger's Nest. Just stroll on up. It's like,
hop on up.
2 hours uphill, steep uphill. Yeah. We're like, did we really need to save this for the last day?
Well, the legend has it that the tiger, there's like a mythical tiger that had wings that flew into it. I think that's what the legend sort of was, what I call the Tiger's Nest. I think I'm getting that right. But it would have been a lot easier growing wings and flying, because walking.
Whew, tough. Yeah. Thanks so that. I said we should actually do it on the first day and it'd be acclimatization type trick, because it's...
That's true. But it is such an iconic image, isn't it? When you think about Bhutan, what sort of springs to mind? You go, well, that image of that
hill.
Structure on top of that, on the mountain, jutting out of the mountainside. So it does give you a lot to look forward to go plodding along throughout these different parts of the country, and then you go, there's that beautiful thing. And I remember it vividly. It's just such a wonderful thing to have done. I think you're not going to be surprised on my answer later in the podcast of what's the favorite place. Spoiler alert, I won't say it, but we'll see.
But it's, you know, and you had... It's funny, yeah, you've had two experiences of Bhutan. So you went, twice, 2013 and 15, I believe.
You know my schedule better than I
do. I used to work for the charity, remember? I knew the whole schedule. I knew when everybody was going everywhere. I saw your face a lot because you were used in the marketing materials, and I was very proud later on that I got used in the marketing materials. I was like, take that, Nick. Who's a Black Dog Institute person now, huh?
Yeah, me. Yeah.
Wear the jumper, get in the brochure. That's the ticket.
That's such good advice. Do you reckon it would work outside of that? Like, if you just printed out a hoodie of, like, I don't know, Nestle tea and just hung around their office, would they be like, you know what, we're going to put you on a billboard and then, you know, give you a bunch of money?
Well, I think it's also that we invested thousands to go on those trips, as well as raised thousands, that they were probably were taking more note of us.
That's probably
not
fair.
They're not cheap trips and they do take a lot of work. Which trip was more challenging? Because I was surprised how challenging the trek in Bhutan was. I, in a way, found it harder than doing Everest Base Camp, to be honest.
Wow. That makes me feel a lot more impressive than I thought I was, because I have not done Everest Base Camp. I do think that Bhutan was probably more challenging than Peru. But my God, like this, I loved it for so many reasons. And in a way, it felt like it wasn't even hard work because you're just so wrapped up in everything that's around you. Well, I should say I found it to be that way. Definitely tricky though when you do have that moment of like, ooh, this is probably could have done a few more walks in advance before leaving. You certainly find, oh yeah. So I loved the surrounding, but it was certainly challenging going. There's some steep inclines. There's definitely some parts where we had this guy in front of us who was probably in his, I don't know, 80s or 90s. There was one day where this old man had sort of come out of some village and was leading part of it. And I'm like, how does this guy just effortlessly walk up this very steep hill?
All the time.
They live up there and do it all the time, so they're sort of used to it.
I know, but it's for me, I should say why it was more challenging was that Everest is a trade route and it's like a path almost, although it's like a gravelly path. It's a path. You know, donkeys use it, yaks use it, humans use it. It's pretty well sort of founded. Whereas where we were in Bhutan, like there were places where we had to watch every single step. Like you were going over pebbles, there were little creeks, you had to, you know, little your boulders or just uneven ground constantly, as well as altitude, as well as the steepness. So I think for me it was like that, having to concentrate all the time. Probably also I was being a leader watching you guys.
Making sure we're staying hydrated and not getting lost. I love the diversity of the landscapes. We were camping down by a still riverside one day and then through snow the next, and then just in this thick grasslands and then up above the tree line and then down again. And it's just, there's so, you'd think it, you're in different countries throughout
every day.
Yeah,
and that was the funny thing for me, because we were so close. We were in the Himalayas, so close to India and Nepal, yet the terrain in parts looked more like Peru to me, especially like there was that day we were coming, went up over a rise and we came down and there was like sort of some lakes and things. Like that was like flashback to Peru. It was crazy.
Yeah.
Like we're in the, but we're in a completely different part of the world. And
that's so true.
It's not the same, but it's like, you know, you do, because some people go, oh, stop comparing places. And I was like, you need a point of reference, you know? It's like,
yeah, I'll do what I want. It's my podcast. I can live my life the way I feel like it. I also love, though, the thinking about sort of coming off the trek and before it, the city. I mean, I guess you'd call it a city, but it's such a small capital that it feels more like a big village, I suppose.
Yeah, Paro.
It was just, how do you even describe it? It's honestly like walking into a movie or something. It just feels like this doesn't feel real. It was quite a surreal experience of nothing really feels familiar enough to say I understand what this is. It's just like going into because the country itself has been quite isolated for a very long time until somewhat recently, but still maintains its cultural identity as a key part of what it sees as its happiness. It is quite unique. And so we go to this city where there isn't even traffic lights, and there's, I think, what, one roundabout maybe.
Oh, they put one in, didn't they? And then everybody was like, I don't know what this crap is, and they took it away.
Yeah. And then you have everyone who's walking around in their traditional garb. There's not the sort of T-shirts and thongs and, you know, sort of stuff. It's everyone's dressed the way they have been for a very long time. And
it's very foreign, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's
but
foreign,
lovely.
But it also feels like it's locked in a time of hundreds of years ago before it had. It feels sort of untouched, I suppose, is maybe a way of putting it.
Except when they're wearing their robes and like Rin Chen reaches in and pulls out his mobile phone. It's like so charming and traditional, and then they just whip out a mobile phone and like you're like,
that's true.
Wow.
Yeah, we went to that. There was that monastery we went to where all these young monks were learning, and yeah, same one just sort of pulls out a the phone. Beep, 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 beep. You're like, oh, just, you're suddenly reminded, like, well, yeah, you can't really.
Oh, wait, we are in 2015.
The reality of the modern world. But, and, you know, they only got TV, I think, in 96 or something like that. And so there's a lot of things that are quite normal for us that have been adopted later for them. And I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, technology is bad. It's, you know, the worst thing in the world. But I think there is something to be said of the assumption that having advanced technology and being on the cutting edge of everything is somehow the preferred way of doing it. I think what Bhutan has shown, and they're not the happiest country in the world. They certainly value it, but they're not the happiest country in the world, so they haven't solved everything. But I think what has been really nice to see is that they put a lot of emphasis on their natural environment and on, I suppose, trying to do as much as they can for most people in the country and having a sort of strong cultural identity. And there's sort of a lot to it. I think what was great for me about this whole trip or trips was not just seeing everything, but trying to work out where that idea of placing happiness as being an important thing above gross domestic product is a measure of how well people are doing in terms of just, you know, mental health.
Well, I loved, our guide Rinchen was amazing. And, you know, one of the things he said was it's like, it was about like having enough. So, you know, they're like, I have a house, I have a business. Because I said, you're so helpful that you're helping your nephew. He's like, I work with my nephew, I work with my friend, da 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 da. I pull this guy in. It was like, once you have enough, like, yeah, of course, work on your own stuff. But you don't need, just because once you've got a house doesn't mean you need a bigger house. And once you've got a car doesn't mean you need a bigger car or more cars. You go, I'm good, but old mate over here is not so good. Or, you know, my nephew's kind of coming up in the world, I'm going to help him. And so it's like this like community feel of let's rise together and having enough. And the other thing was when we were up at the Tiger's Nest, Rinchen, I asked him about the Dalai Lama because they are Buddhists, but there's different strains of Buddhism. And so they were like, Dalai Lama's not like the big thing for us over here. We've got our own stuff. But it's like, let's not talk about that. Like, let's just talk about like, what does Buddhism mean? It just goes into this kind of like philosophical thing. And he just talked about being good. And he's like, you know, we used to say like, you know, good has become average almost. So if you're like, you have to be great and you have to be wonderful. He's like, to say somebody is good, to be a good person, to have a good life, to do good is such a, is something to aspire to. And I just sat there bawling my eyes out at his talking. Like, it was so simple and so beautiful. It's like, it's just that, let's have enough, be enough, know that you're enough and be good. Be a good person, do good things. Good is,
he was
is
such
a good
a wise
word.
Guy, Rinchen. It was, I found myself chatting to him a lot throughout our trek. So he for the listeners, Rinchen was, I think, the first official government tour guide. Am I right about, I think he,
he's,
I mean, he could be
there.
Lying, but I think he was one of the first, because when he was a young lad, he was sort of running off into the woods and sort of finding his own path and whatnot. And when the government decided to sort of focus more on tourism, they said, well, we need to have a guide. How about we tap Rinchen and get him doing it? And what's great about, and a couple of points you made I want to touch on, but what I love about the way they have preserved the beauty of the place is you can't just sort of turn up and just go, oh, I'm going to just go wherever I want and walk around. You actually are required to have a tour guide that's authorized by the government. So there is quite a high cost to having a visa. When we were there, the visa cost per day was $90, which sounds extreme, but
well, and
it includes
spend.
The guide. Yeah, so it does actually come with a guide and a few other things. So what's great about that is you have tourists being able to see so much and get a lot out of it, but also not just sort of run rampant. So back to what you're saying about cars and houses, I think one of the really cool things they've done is the government has recognized the importance of these things, and they've actually legislated certain things which has probably helped the country not go the way of other smaller nations that have experienced an influx of tourism and have in some ways have what makes them tarnished in some way by foreign investment and a you know, swarm of tourists. So what they've done is, and I don't know if it's in response to tourism or not, but it's certainly related to it. When anyone builds there, any sort of, whether it's a hotel or a house or whatever, it has to be in a Bhutanese style. So you're not seeing big, fancy, modern Hiltons. It's all the traditional, which is probably why it feels like you're stepping into another time, because it's
so stunning.
Just the way it looked hundreds and hundreds of years ago. It's absolutely gorgeous. And then also with talking about, you know, fancy cars and whatnot, they have some funny taxes. So there's a huge tax on luxury import cars, and also cigarettes. You can only bring in, I think, maybe like one packet, which is taxed like crazy as well. They don't really have a lot of smoking there, which is probably quite unique for Asia compared to a lot of other Asian nations. So you do sort of get not a lot of outward displays of wealth. It sort of helps solidify a culture of perhaps being a bit more humble. And
absolutely.
What I found really interesting about what Rinchen was telling us is, so for a very long time they've had a royal family, which probably unlike the rest of royal families, until quite recently were not figureheads. They actually were sort of benevolent dictators, even decades past when that was more common in other parts of the world. And it was only, I think, maybe in sort of like the don't quote me on this, but recently-ish, where they actually established a parliament and made the royal family not have quite so much control over everything. And what's interesting is talking to our tour guide, who's kind of saying how, and I suppose partly because it is such a small country as far as population goes, there's a lot more efficiency there. And the king still has a lot of say in what happens, but it seems like they'll do something like, okay, we want to have conversation with the prince, and what's this? So the king decided that we're going to have, I think it might have been free tertiary education, and the king has a 4-year plan. And I was like, okay, the king says in 4 years' time we're going to have education for everybody. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Like, so like, what happened? Did they do it? He's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, so, like, was it like, but that's got to be a, like, it just blew, like, how do you just go, well, the king said it's going to happen, so let's make it happen. In my mind, I'm like, there's got to be committees, there's got to be working groups, there's got to be opposition to it, there has to be lobbying. And it's sort of fairly uncomplicated.
And they really love the royal family, but yeah, it was, you know,
and what a good looking couple as well.
Oh, they were very attractive people.
Does
very
your show notes allow photos, or is it just text?
Oh, absolutely.
I want them to see how good looking this royal family is.
They are, and they're on a lot of things, so you get to see them a lot, but they're very lovely people. Yeah, our friend Fiona, who was on the trek, she said, described Bhutan as being aesthetically pleasing to the eye. And I thought that was a very apt description. Just everywhere you look is just kind of postcard-ish. Like, you just take a snapshot and be like, and there's not going to be a sign ruining the view or like a traffic light or whatever. Like, it's just, here's your gorgeous. And the buildings are kind of white with like, mahogany almost door and maybe they have some, and then they have the colored rainbow flags around, and so there's this real simple white, a little bit of color, and then just stunning greenery everywhere. It's
now you mentioned, I'm trying to think what did make it feel so unique, and I think despite tourism being, I think it's their second biggest export, it's a big part of their economy is tourism. It didn't feel like there were tourists around.
Well, it's so well managed. It's very restricted.
It felt like we're the only ones there in a way. It just felt like, compared to, say, Peru or China or whatever, you go, I'm very much one of millions of people who are here looking at Machu Picchu or the Great Wall or whatever. It really, certainly you see other tourists there, but it doesn't feel like that's a huge thing that surrounds you everywhere.
No, and so at the time, I think the visa was one part of it, but the cost per day minimum spend was like $250. So it's like if you're going for a 10-day trip, you're looking at minimum $2,500 US, which is unlike other, as you said, like Asian countries generally, people go, they're thinking it's going to be cheap. There really isn't a cheap way to get into Bhutan. I think for a few different countries they can get in through different routes, but you have to fly into Paro. That's kind of like quite strict as well, like where you enter the country. And then the visa thing is quite strict. And look, I totally respect it because some people go, oh, it's so hard and da-da-da and it costs so much and it's very, what do you call it? There's a good word. I can't think of it. But it stops people from going. And I'm like, but that's okay because some of the people, the dickheads who are running around wanting to make, prohibitive, yes. Yes, it's very prohibitive. But, for good reason. Like, they want you to understand about the culture. They want you to go and respect it and they want you to – they don't want to have it overrun. And there's something about as well I think it's like 75% of educators must be Bhutanese. So they will have expats come in, but then they're only allowed to stay for a certain time. So you couldn't go there and end up working for 10 years. You'd probably go and do a term of a couple of years so that they, again, maintain the roles for Bhutanese people and keep that culture there. I respect, I absolutely really respect it. I think they've introduced it in a really great way and we still got to experience it. So, but tell me, first time you had a very unique experience because you had a bit of a weather disaster on your first trip.
We did. We had a weather disaster, which turned out to be one of those things where you go, I'm actually glad it happened because it's one of those like do it for the story things. Yeah. We had no idea it was going to happen, but we were trekking up this mountain and by sheer luck, one of our fellow trekkers, had needed to descend because she had, what's it called?
Altitude sickness.
And lucky us. So we had to descend being like, oh, that's annoying. It's going to cut the day short. But it was fortunate because the storm rolled in, which came out of nowhere, and it turned out to be this, like, monsoon-type weather.
Was it a typhoon?
Absolutely fucking dead. Yeah, it was just...
Which is pretty crazy for mountain territory.
It was pretty full-on. It was just this... And so we're going down this mountain into a valley, and this is off the path. There's going to be some information center down there. Just, we're going into... a jungle type environment into a valley and we don't know what's down there. And so I don't know if you've had that experience where you have a tour guide and he usually has he or she has some people with them who are kind of, helping out and whatnot. And they're all speaking in Bhutanese at each other and they're speaking in it at greater frequency than they normally would, and they're pulling out their phones and talking to people, and you're like, I don't know if there's a plan ahead of us. We're just trying to see what happens. But we get down to the bottom of this valley and we come across a local school, a primary school, and our leader went and spoke to the principal. It was outside of school hours, and he basically organized for us to stay the night in this little school. And so we just sort of cleared just to get out of the rain. So we cleared the chairs and tables and we all just got our sleeping bags out and just lay on the floor, this little tiny dark classroom just on these floorboards. And the next day we woke up and the weather had gotten a bit better. But what was really funny is seeing this little boy turned up to class. He didn't get the message because he just lives in a remote area. This boy usually wakes up at something like, I think, 3 or 4 in the morning and walks by himself for a couple of hours through the wilderness to get to school. And he didn't get the message. So he turns up in this, you know, nice little uniform, turns up, walks into class. There's, you know, 15 foreigners there just, you know, playing cards or chatting, whatever, turning over and looking at him. And the look in this little boy is just like,
the terror.
What's going on? So he came over to Rinchen and they spoke about what was happening and stuff. But it was a really unique experience. And it was great because we actually got to see the how education works there and spoke about, and, you know, what a lot of what I do is working with schools, you know, doing mental health education. So seeing how that works in this totally foreign country that is very different to our own, and a part of it that is even sort of off limits to tourists usually, was just fascinating. And what we actually learned later, unfortunately, for other trekkers who were ahead of us in different groups, they had to be medevaced out because they got stuck up there with the weather. So we were quite fortunate. And this tour guide group was so lovely to us. They organized other things for us to do for a few days while we were sort of out of action, seeing different cultural sites. And and the woman who owned the company was so apologetic, and she gave us like bottles of wine and stuff. And we're like, you don't have to apologize for the weather. It's not your fault. Well, like, you've done everything you can to help.
But
you.
Some people get really fixated, and I've been a tour leader. I was the tour leader for our 2015 one. Some people get really fixated on the itinerary and on the plan and on the route. It's a very Western way of thinking. Whereas, you know, I think, you know, hopefully people are there for the experience. I know that you are very much always there for the experience and like see what happens. But it's funny, when being the tour leader, the next time they were doing the risk assessment, and we were going, me and one of the staff were going through the risk assessment. I said, oh, do you have something in there for typhoons? And she said, no. And I said, well, considering 2 years ago they went to Bhutan with this same charity and they had a typhoon, I do feel that we should have a risk assessment and
deserve some assessing.
A plan. So I'd like, I won't sign off on this until you get that done. And they're like, she's like, oh, well, why would we have a typhoon? I'm like, because it happened.
Because it happened. It does. But you're so right about the itinerary. My grand, when we had years ago, we had a family reunion in Disney World in America. And my grandpa put together a spreadsheet of like organizing what we're going to do at what time of what day, like how to have fun using Microsoft Excel. So it can sort of take a bit of the magic out of it. There's certainly something to be said of having an idea in advance of what things you might want to go check out, so you don't learn about it when you come home and go, oh, I didn't know that thing existed. It would have been great to go see. But I think there's also something to be said of being a little bit free and loose.
Well, and trusting that you have a guy. I love when people come up to me, they're like, where are we having dinner tonight? And I'm like, are you familiar with the restaurants of Paro, Bhutan? And they're like, no. And I'm like, well, will it help you if I tell you what the restaurant name is? And they're like, no. And I was like, let's see what happens then, shall we? Yeah.
You know, like, and the food, the food is amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah, chili, the chili, the pepper, like the snow peas in cheese thing. Chili cheese, vegetable stuff. Mm. And we were so fortunate. We had our beautiful guide. I have just found a note in my phone of because I was learning the language. I was like chatting away with them, learning the language. But Kuzu Zangpola is hello. I can't seem to find the rest of my wonderful Bhutanese, but one of the words, chili, Emma meant chili.
Enough to get by.
Yeah, Emma meant chili. I knew that. So, or spicy.
Emma meant chili. Oh, so your name.
My name is a word in Bhutanese, yeah.
It's
so,
like in Japan, my name, Nick, or Niku, means meat. So I'm a vegetarian whose name is meat.
Well, and what I've also found is, you know, we ended up giving nicknames. I love learning the guys' names. And like you mentioned before, we had a crew of about 10 or 15 guys, I think about 15 guys. And we had, along with that, about 10 or 15 horses, which is super cool. So they'd go off with our horses. And then we had a dog that followed us. She was beautiful. Yeah. Slept in my outside my tent one night. So it's quite a because we were camping, so they take all the stuff on the horses and they set up the tent and they cook for you. Like, it's quite phenomenal what they do, and you totally respect why you have to pay money to do it. But they're just so beautiful. It's like becomes a big family. Anyway, we had nicknames. You were Nick the Whisperer Newling.
Because I never did.
Maybe it was irony. Yeah. But Phil, our wonderful friend Phil, had many a nickname. Apparently he was Dropper, Peanut, Paff, Paff King, Marathon Man, Mountain Man, Pace Setter, and Felipe.
What was Paff?
Paff was pensive as, excuse me, I'm going to swear, pensive as fuck, because Phil used to go and just stand on a rock and just look out
deep,
and just have this
deep man.
Yeah, deep thought. And he would, like, in the morning, he should be like, where's Phil? And he's sitting over on the other side of camp on a rock just looking out. He's a very thoughtful man, Phil.
He's a thoughtful man. He's actually sort of, in a way, carried the mantle of what we were doing out there and raising money. So he does plenty of marathons just for fun, which is my idea of hell, but apparently it's a thing that people do for fun. And what he does is he actually raises money to support my work in school. So we've kept in touch, become really good friends.
Phil Durney, Phil Durney, wonderful man.
Yes. And his organization is Cool and with the Black Dog. We'll put that in the show notes. I've decided as your co-host. Now,
can you write the show notes, please? Because you're creating a lot of work for me. So I'm going to delegate that to you, back to you, Nick.
We're also going to put in Bhutan's third biggest export in there, because we both, on top of our head, don't know that. So we'll make sure someone fact-checks that at the office.
I tell Darius to listen. I'm like, Darius, do my annotating as I go.
Oh, no.
Hi, guys. It's Darius here from the editing room. Thank you very much for giving me some extra facts to check and some show notes that I can fill out. I went on the Ministry of Finance website from Bhutan and checked section 3 of the 2019 stats, and it tells me that petroleum and gasoline were the third most exported goods from Bhutan. So do with that what you will. Back to you, Nick and Emma.
But no, Phil is a wonderful person to share a tent with, because, yeah, he's very funny and obviously very, very deep as well. But my favourite nickname for Phil was Bag Drop, because he dropped a bag. It's one of those things where, like,
have to go on a trek to understand where this stupid stuff comes from.
Yeah, very insignificant things. He dropped a bag once, and we're like, bag drop. And that, so every time I go to an airport now, and you know when they have, like, the bag drops, there's a big sign saying bag drop. Yeah. I just take a photo and send it to him, like, hey, baggy, thinking of you. Hope you're well. So, we made some really good friends along the way, didn't we? But that dog that was part of our trek,
she was so beautiful.
I don't know what it was, a dog. No, it was a boy. I remember because Rinchen, who actually speaks very, very good. So Rinchen speaks very good English, but there's certain words that you know what they're saying but doesn't quite make sense. So rather than saying his dog was a good boy, he was saying he's a good chap. something you might say about, if you were like 90 or something. He's a good chap. But anyway, this dog was a smart dog. He followed us throughout the whole week. He wasn't anyone. He was just a stray. But he basically follows each trekking group through because he knows he's going to get fed at every campsite.
Oh, I was happy too. Out. And it rained the last night, and I coaxed the dog. I didn't let it into my tent, but there's kind of like a little balcony section, if you will. So I let the dog sleep in the balcony section of my...
Emma obviously has the 5-star treatment with the spa and balcony tent. Everyone else is roughing it in our normal 2-person.
Well, people are always like, do you do camping? And I'm like, I do glamping. Like, I love it, love being out in the wilderness, but I really need a team of 15 or so. I need horses.
I love the observatory deck of my tent.
I'm just trying to give it a good... But it is glamping, honestly. Like, they set it up for us. They bring you tea in the morning. They bring you water to wash your hands. They really won't let you. I mean, we helped one day because the camp was flooding after the snow was melting. So do you remember that? We set up a little, like...
Was that when Phil and I were off away somewhere?
Oh, yeah, you guys were probably buggered off.
We have no idea. We come back, oh, the place is speaking Span. I'm glad someone did that.
The water was, because the snow was melting, it was like going into the food tent. So we created this little like chain of workers, a little working bee, where we were all scooping the water and because they were trying to do it and there was like two of them and we're like, we can help. And they're like, no, don't help. And we're like, clearly we have nothing else to do. We can help. And so we were all passing these buckets of water along and that's the stuff. That's the stuff that makes these trips amazing, those little moments that you don't expect, the time with the people, the time with the locals. I mean, I've committed to Rincheng that we're going to write a book, so I've got to get back there. Sat me down one day under a tree and told me we really needed to talk more about Bhutan and get it out in the world, and that I was the one to write said book. So apparently I'm going back.
You're like, you're like the Apostle Paul of your generation.
I don't even know if I told him that I am a writer, but he just had this sense that I'm that person.
Someone's got to do it. She seems to know what she's doing. Let's pick her. No, it's true. Because there's a few misconceptions about Bhutan, and one of them is that they have harsh restrictions on how many people are allowed to come in. And Rinchen said, no, like the more the merrier. Don't hold back. You know, please, if you're a tourist and wants to visit, come along, please.
I mean, not right now, probs.
No, probably not right this very
second. Please don't take the pandemic into Bhutan. That would not really bode well.
That would not be great. No, traditional culture.
But look, you mentioned before about some of the work that you're doing with Phil, and one of the reasons that I wanted to get you on as well, not only because we had fabulous times trekking together and visiting the beautiful Bhutan, but also because you are an incredible mental health advocate. And the mission behind this podcast, as you mentioned, was to visit every UN-recognized country. But my part of that mission for me is talking about mental health and raising awareness for mental health. And I feel that travel greatly contributes to my well-being, and I would love to learn more about how it's approached in the world, and Bhutan was obviously a very special place for that. But how did you get into the mental health space, and what is your organization and the work you're doing?
Yeah, thank you so much. I just love how we have so much overlap in our interests. Obviously, mental health is a huge part of what I do, and being involved or working for Black Dog Institute at the time when we met and did those treks was obviously something we both have a strong interest in. And so I left Black Dog after about 6 years to start doing my own thing. And I have an organization called The Champion. And we say we champion sharing to help improve mental health. And so it's a way of getting to different communities, you know, schools and workplaces and whatnot, and speaking about mental health in a very honest and real way. So I speak about it from my own lived experience perspective as someone who has struggled a lot with mental illness, and also having lost my brother to suicide when I was in high school, who then I was very much diverted from my path of what I thought I was going to do. I found it very hard to continue school, so I left and didn't go to uni. So it was sort of what's going to happen. I ended up working in mental health, and I found that to be a very, very meaningful thing. And so I talk about things from my own perspective and try to inject a bit of humor in with, you know, all the really challenging stuff as well, on all sort of doom and gloom. But then I sort of marry that with what knowledge we can all take from that. I don't want it to be like, oh, here's a story, the end. Now what? What can we do? What can the science tell us? What can we learn from this to sort of help ourselves and each other? And then I just do a really big open Q&A session. So we just sort of open up the conversation and talk. And part of that often involves getting local service providers to be a part of that conversation as well, because I find so much of what is challenging is that people often, not always, but often there is support available in their communities. More often than not, there's support available. But there's barriers in place, whether it be the stigma around it, whether it be just the thought that, oh, what I'm going through isn't that bad, and or maybe that's financial. Sort of for other people, but not for me. Financial can be a big one as well. So just picking apart some of those things and trying to affect a bit of change in helping more people access the help that they deserve. And not just going once, but sort of understanding that it is a bit like going to the gym. You know, you sort of, me and my friend, when we were doing basketball in year 9, and we thought, oh, we better get ripped before the season starts. So we went to the gym once, and we're like, cool, that about does it. Not realizing, of course, that you have to sort of go more than 20 minutes one time. So there's a lot to help seeking beyond just sort of going once. It's getting as much out of it as you can and sort of giving as much as you can as well to sort of open up a bit more. So it's about sort of changing attitudes. It's about normalizing mental illness and understanding it from a real human perspective, not just the stats and figures. And ultimately, it's about affecting change to sort of improve the well-being of as many people as we can. So that's sort of what I spend a lot of my time doing now.
I love the way you talk about it and your humor and your openness. And I think, you know, the stigma is definitely lifting somewhat, but there's still not this sort of way you would say, my knee hurts, I'm going to the physio. You wouldn't talk about, you know, my brain isn't really feeling great. No, I'm going to the counselor or the psychologist. And, you know, I think I'd love to, you know, there's still this thing about I'm struggling. It's a struggle, or I'm, you know, then you're less than, as opposed to life is sometimes challenging and things can be a lot. And if you've been through a tough time, or I think the hard part is actually people who haven't been through a trauma or haven't been through a difficulty and they're just feeling pretty crap. And there's no trigger and they're like, but you know, on the surface, everything's okay. My life is good, you know, and I, you know, and then there's a guilt that comes with it and all that sort of stuff. But it's like you said, it's just working on it. And sorry to be lame and about it, but mental health is a journey. And it's something I've had to learn. I think that people think you get fixed, but it's not something to be fixed. It's an ongoing.
No, it's an ongoing thing. You touched on a really important one, I think, actually. And it's the same one that I experienced. It's going, well, my family life is pretty good and, you know, what have I got to complain about? You know, we're not sort of starving in the street and there's billions of people out there who are way, way worse off. So I'm sort of, you know, wasting a counsellor's time by sitting in that chair and talking to them. And really you go, that's actually just another one of those barriers to help seeking. And we think about the ones of, you know, distance and cost and stigma, but very often there is that sort of self stigma of going, oh, I don't deserve it, it's not that bad, I don't need, you know, that's to me, that's a very common one that I do come across in my work. And also with stigma, like, I think we absolutely have come a long way. I've been seeking tools for a very long time now, and I've seen it shift, seen the rise of all different kinds of public-facing organisations that have shifted public attitudes about it. But I collect data at every school and workplace I visit to see what effect it's having, to sort of understand and make sure I'm sort of delivering in a way that's most useful. And what I find surprisingly in schools, that only about 4% of students say that stigma is not a problem in their school. So a huge majority say stigma is still an issue.
Okay.
Which is surprising. I would have thought, oh, maybe we're sort of, I think we are getting a lot better, but I think at least in that age group, a lot of people still go, there's a tendency to go, there's something with that that is maybe we shouldn't talk about, or it's hard to talk about, or maybe that does make someone, you know, a bit weak in some ways or whatever it might be. So we've come a long way, but we've got a long way to go as well, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And I think people are okay to talk about it when it's not them. So there's a little bit of like, oh, so if you're talking about having a mental health challenge, they can kind of have empathy for you and understand and go, okay, yep, you get the help and support you in that way. But then it's like if the mirror was turned around, you know, they're looking at themselves, well, but not me. And I think as well, some places have, like my husband's work has put in, they can have a mental health day but he doesn't know how to do that. Like, how do you approach, you know, I know I'm allowed, I know they're there, but how do I use them? Like, there's sort of a lack of education or a gap there. And it's like, yes, we have it, but people aren't utilizing it or understanding how to use it. And my thing to him, and where I see Mental Health Day, is that you take it before the crisis, you take it before the trauma, you take it before you're burnt out. You take it so that you don't get to that point. You just need a break. You need time for yourself. You need to do whatever you need to do for your self-care, so that you're not crashing and burning. But I don't know if workplaces understand that either.
Well, I think even for the ones that do, there's still that very often that unspoken cultural attitude of you're letting the team down a little bit. Or even if I didn't tell anybody that I'm having a mental health day, let's just say I was in that position, I myself as a worker, as part of a team, say I was in a corporate environment, I might go, oh, well, I am letting the team down, even if people don't know why I'm taking the day off. So I think that's one of the areas we have a long way to go in. But speaking about that idea of a journey that you mentioned, one of the questions I had the other day at a school, a rural school, was about the stigma of treatment, not just the stigma of being unwell, because I do see that as the next frontier. I think we have gotten a lot better in destigmatizing people having a mental illness, or whether, even if it's not a diagnosable condition, even if it's just like just going through a really shitty time. But I think what people do struggle with in terms of this is a weird thing to talk about, is different kinds of treatment and the struggles that people will have throughout that journey, how to address how it affects people's lives, how it affects their ability to be the best friend that they want to be, and how it might affect their ability to work, and all those sorts of things that seem to be a bit more taboo still, which are actually probably even more important than destigmatizing than just the condition itself.
Yeah, there's a lot of work to be done, but I mean, honestly, I love how what you're doing. It makes me smile every time. I know my mum's one of your biggest fans. We love her.
No,
she's like, her. Nick's doing this. Did you know? And I'm like, I also have Instagram, mum. Yep, I'm on it. I see her comment. Sometimes the post wouldn't come up for me, but mum's commented on it, so I get to see it. And then also a big fan of you, but also of your mother, who wrote, and I will put it in the show notes, but I'll also put up a picture, her fabulous book called Missing Christopher, which was about your family's journey and about your brother, which is incredibly helpful for people who are in grief and for people to understand, and for her to write that. I know that was very important and special for you too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think when we were going through the grief of losing someone to suicide in the family, there wasn't really a blueprint for how to go, or anything, how to go about grieving, just managing, just maintaining. There wasn't a lot to go off. And there is more these days, but what she's provided, which I think is really unique, is it's not even meant to be a guide. It's just an honest, it's a memoir.
It's a lived experience, which is really helpful.
So much that people can learn from that, and a lot that I'm sure we wish we could have known at the time. But she's done a wonderful job of it, and it's certainly helped me a lot. And I know it's helped many, many people. So she gets emails from people saying that it's changed their life and saved their lives in some cases as well. So it's I'm also very proud of my mum. So we. Another thing that you and I share in common.
I still got to meet her. I feel like I know her.
I can't believe you haven't met her.
Shout out to Jane.
So weird. Hi, Jane. She'll be listening to this, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yay. No, it's phenomenal, and I love that angle of it, and it's something I'm going to be working on with you. We discussed it off air, but my pregnancy journey, and I just think there's a gap sometimes in there's heaps of, how, like you said, guides, how-tos, instructions, help, fact sheets, all that sort of stuff, but just hearing that someone else has gone through it. And so I've had a really tough time with my pregnancy, and it's really brought up a lot of that mental health stuff for me, and I think it brings up a lot of mental health stuff for a lot of women, but that's a whole new kettle of fish. You can't really talk about that because you you know, got to love your baby, love my baby, but having a really tough time too. So I want to just talk about what I've gone through. And if that helps somebody to go, oh my gosh, I felt that way too, then that's what it's about, you know. And it's like, I just say, you know, call myself the scapegoat sometimes, but if I've got to be out there and cop the tough conversations and things so that somebody else can have an easier conversation, then.
Oh, absolutely. No, there's a lot of pressure on women. And I say this as a woman who has been pregnant, obviously not.
You've been pretty close to one.
Yeah, right. Obviously being in an age where a lot of people in my circle are having babies, and obviously my wife has also had a little boy, Finn. And I think there is a lot of pressure on women to act in a certain way or to have a certain experience that is considered the right one, whether it might be, you know, how you choose to give birth, or, you know, whether it's breastfeeding or bottle feeding or whatever it might be. And it's sort of much of a muchness with a lot of these decisions, and the people present it as like, that's one that's right for you and your baby and one that's not. And it's like, well, maybe don't be so judgmental and, you know, don't try to control everyone just to be like you. Yeah. But
I don't know if I can say that. It comes into many areas of life, mental health, and I think, you know, I really love the way that you're addressing it and coming at it from the lived experience is so important. And especially I just see those kids in the photos, those kids in high school, seeing this cool dude come into school, laid back.
We have a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun. You know what? It's funny because, like, my speaking style is just sort of pretty cash and sort of off the cuff, and so we just sort of roll with it. But it sort of lends itself to being really serious and deep at times, but also there is a lot of fun we have. I was speaking in rural Victoria, and I so often speak to students during the day and then parents or teachers at night. And I had one parent come up to me and she said, look, my daughter came home today and said, we saw this mental health talk today at school, and like, mom and dad, you have to go tonight to see him speak as well. And then she said to me, she was like, but she did say we had this talk about suicide and it was so funny. And she's like, are you sure? Like, that doesn't sound like a very funny topic. And she's like, no, I wasn't like making fun of it. It was a story that had a lot of seriousness to it, but also it's a reflection of life, and there's parts where you just have to laugh as well, you know. So I think it is important to present this stuff as being real, which isn't all just doom and gloom, and it's not all just like inspiration and triumph over adversity. It's what real life is, what everyone experiences. It's there's a lot of complexity to it, and part of that is really pleasurable and part of it's not. And when we come across situations where people find the not to be more deeper or more frequent than they want it to be, then we work out, well, what can we learn from science and research and each other's experiences to try to improve our situation. So I think that's sort of what we focus on.
I love it. And look, we can't finish this podcast without mentioning the Bhutan salad. So please explain the salad of Bhutan.
I texted you a couple of weeks ago because I did a rural tour just a couple of weeks ago, thanks to Phil Durney's organisation, Calling with a Black Dog, that he raised funds for to get me out in some rural locations in New South Wales. And so I shared a few photos from our Bhutan trek, and this is where Phil and I met, and this is where the sort of idea was born. And I came across one of them, which was just quite a large, maybe like the size of a loaf of bread, a smooth rock. And it just had a printed out label taped to it, which said salad. And I was like, what is that? And what had happened was, we were at this restaurant, and I think it was I think it was just like, it was meant to be like the rock itself was a label, and it was just sort of sitting in front of a big bowl of salad. Say, this is the salad, this is the cheese, this is the whatever on a big long table. And for whatever reason, it had been moved. So it was just like sitting on our table saying, salad. And I'm like, no, it's not. Rock. Why is, I didn't get it. And then someone pointed, like, oh, okay. Not like some thing that I understand. So I obviously found it hilarious, took a photo and texted to saying, hey, looking forward to being on the podcast. Here's a salad.
I just love the things that, like, you know, yeah, that we all have these moments that stand out. There's like epic views, there's the tiger's nest, there's this golden Buddha, there's these beautiful garments, and you're just like, salad.
Salad.
And salad, it'll stay there forever. Salad. But
it will.
I loved on what you said before.
Card somewhere.
There's going to be, someone's going to get there and be like, I'm very confused. Yeah. I need a backstory. Yeah. Well, here it is. This is the backstory, guys. But, I absolutely love that you said as well that this idea came, you know, you met Phil there, that friendship has blossomed. We were obviously doing that trip. I love travel with a purpose. We were traveling there, raising funds. You know, we were all there talking about mental health, and that fact that now 5 years later you are doing this work. And for me, you know, the idea for the podcast came like on the way back from Mongolia last year on a plane, being like, I want to visit every country and I want to do it and I want to talk about mental health and I want to like – help people. And like, then, you know, and I want, you know, then we decided to start a podcast and like, here I am. I love that travel can foster, it gives you the space and the freedom and, you know, to generate those ideas, to build those relationships and to actually like take action that if you didn't travel, if you didn't take that trip, you might not be where we are today.
Yeah, definitely. That's such a good way of putting it.
You and I wouldn't be here today.
And you've just worked out the ending to the episode. I think you've like, did you plan this? You're like, I'm going to get his salad story
and then I'm just going to be heaps profound at the end.
Yeah, you know me. And then make him look like a bit of an idiot because he ended on a salad rock piece and yet I've got this like, and then we went to the moon sort of like.
But Nick, I can't, but that is you. Like I can't, you know, we have these beautiful, deep, wonderful conversations and then we're total dickheads. So
absolutely.
That's
which
life.
Is the way it should be done. That's how I'm going to raise my son.
Oh, I love it.
To be a poignant dickhead.
Oh, what an ambition. Thank you so much for your time. And I genuinely heartfelt thanks for sharing your story and for always being such a beautiful light in my life. So,
That's so kind of you. And likewise, thank you for having me on here. And look out for the show notes for a photo of that salad rock, a coin that Rinchen gave me, and some information about the national animal of Bhutan that we went and saw.
Everybody. You are doing these show notes. You're creating way too much work for me.
Hey, it's the end of the year. I'm going to unplug my computer and you'll never hear from me again.
Boom. Thank you, my friend.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Already looking forward to the next one. We also have a rather extensive back catalogue for you to check out. But in the meantime, you can follow us on Instagram. That's at Lovely Travels on Instagram.
Or you can come and check us out on Facebook, Lovely Travels, that's LOVELLY. Or we would love for you to join our Facebook community with more than 500 members talking all things travel and adventure. That's the Lovely Travels community.
You can also visit our website, which is lovelytravels.com.
Or shoot us an email. We love hearing from our listeners, so please send us an email, feedback, comments, questions, whatever. info@lovelytravels.com.
And you can listen, review, subscribe, like, share, and promote our podcast in any shape, way, or form. We are on Spotify, iTunes, the internet, Google Podcasts. Everywhere where you get podcasts, you will find us.
All good podcasting locations. So tune in next time, guys. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you then.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.